And now it is time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member since 12-7-06. Her service commitments could take up an entire meeting, but currently include chairperson for the Fresno County Youth Group and the Fresno County PICPC, which she can explain to you because I don't remember what it stands for. She is also a member of the Fresno County Intergroup Board. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, California, Jill W.
Hi, you guys. My name's Jill Wilson, and I'm an alcoholic. That kind of introduction could put some pressure on you. My sobriety date is December 7th, 2006. Definitely God-given, because for me, being a real alcoholic, when I pick up a drink, you know, when I take one sip of alcohol, I don't know if I'm going to be able to stop or if I'm going to stay stopped. And I'm definitely affected by the phenomenon of craving. And, Gabriel, welcome. I hope that you find an Alcoholics Anonymous what I found here, and that's a loving God that keeps me sober. I'm from Fresno. The few things that Mark was talking about, I'll explain it real quick, but they're just service commitments, and I don't have like an AA service resume. It's just opportunities that I've had to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the thing that he wanted me to explain was it's PICPC. It's a service structure within Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of people get it mixed up as PICPP a lot. And it's not that. It's public information and cooperating with the professional community. And basically what that is we go out to places that need to know that Alcoholics Anonymous is available. We don't go there to try to so much, we don't share about so much the steps and stuff, although it's involved in that, but just to let them know Alcoholics Anonymous is available and to cooperate with the professional community, such as nurses, doctors, social workers, DUI teachers, judges, you name it, that would need to maybe send people that they work with into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's what that is, and it's been an opportunity and a privilege to serve, you know, on that committee. Let's see, a little history about myself. I come from a kind of a small family, at least my immediate family. There's just four of us, myself, my younger brother, who's 4 years younger than me, and my mom and dad, but we have a pretty large family. But I'm the only alcoholic within my family. And for any of you that have any misconceptions about alcoholism, I was raised with a lot of love in my home. My parents are still together. They rarely drink. I would try to encourage it because I'm like, if you could just take the edge off, you know, like I might be able to hang out with you. But they're very good examples of great role models. You know, we had good relationships growing up. I was very well provided for, sometimes probably to a fault, you know, and so there was nothing like externally that would make you think that like I was going to become an alcoholic. And you know, a lot of people that don't understand alcoholism are like, oh my gosh, you know, I can't believe you drank that way, or I can't believe you did those things. And you know, behind my alcoholism, I did a lot of things that I didn't even expect. You know, I surprised myself. And but I, you know, I've had a great life, and I took my first drink at about age 13. The first time I drank like 9 shots of Goldschlager. I ended up blacking out that night, and it was a hoot. But I'll just leave it at that. But I woke up the next day and I was sick, and it's not like I told myself I was never going to do that again. As a matter of fact, I was going to do that again as soon as I could get my hands on it. But at 13 years old, it's not exactly easy. I drank through high school, you know, when I could, and then probably by the end of high school, like, my drinking had progressed to where I was drinking a lot more than I needed to. But the thing about me was that I kept everything together on the outside. Like, for myself, being an alcoholic, I'm driven by that self-centered fear, and I think I was born with that out of the gate, you know, and I have this big fear of disappointing, like, my family. And so I always made sure everything was, like, kept together on the outside, you know, and I wasn't going to give myself away, and I became very sneaky at a young age to try to drink, you know, and I loved what alcohol did for me. And I don't know what it was that it did for me. I really don't know, and I don't particularly care, but I loved it. You know, I started drinking, like the book talks about, essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And then, you know, at some point I crossed that line to where I developed that craving, like I needed it. Alcohol became a necessity for me. And, so by the end of high school, I was drinking a lot, and, you know, drugs are a part of my story as well, and thank God for the drugs, because I probably dropped Alcoholics Anonymous sooner. And I, at the end of high school, I got offered, you know, an opportunity to go to Long Beach State and to be on the dance team there and to go to college. And you know, our book tells us about our thinking, you know, like the alcoholic is affected by alcohol. Our bodies are affected, but our minds are affected as well. And like my thinking about that was not that I was going to go and get this opportunity to go to school or anything. You know, like I had an opportunity that some people don't even get. But I was really excited to get away from my family and be able to drink the way that I wanted to. And not have to come home and see that look of disappointment on their face and not have to lie every day about what I was doing. Like, that was a relief to me and I couldn't wait. And I got down there and, you know, my parents, you know, were paying for part of my education and they were paying for the condo that I lived in and all of this stuff. And I completely took advantage of them and I drank every day and I let alcohol dictate my life at that point, you know. And, I lasted down in Long Beach like a year, and at this point I already feel like I was an alcoholic. I was already suffering from that craving and the obsession that the book talks about, and because of that I would do anything and everything that I needed to do to change the way that I felt. It didn't matter. And I had started doing things to get alcohol and, you know, to get drugs that I wasn't raised to do. I wasn't paying my bills. That definitely came last. Alcohol came first. And I wasn't, you know, I didn't keep in contact too much with my family, or I kept in contact just enough to not have them worry. And I was hanging out with the wrong crowd, and part of that wrong crowd was some of my family members that lived down there. And we got involved in, like, this prescription drug ring, you know, and so I'm drinking and I'm using every day. And I would go back and forth, like, to Mexico to support my habit, and it was nothing to me. It was just what you did, but I got caught, and I got arrested there, and I went to jail, and I'm 18 years old, and I'm in jail, and that was the first time that I, like, wore off forever. I was never going to drink again, and I was praying to a God that I did not believe in, please get me out of here. I will never drink. I will never do drugs. I won't smoke another cigarette. I will not swear, cheat, lie, no premarital sex. Like, I would have become a nun at that point if it meant that I could get out of there, you know. And a few days later, I get out of there, and I get my car back, and, you know, they had ransacked everything, and I look in the side panel of my car, and they had left some of the stuff that I purchased down there, and I took it. You know, without even thinking. Just that mental blank spot that the book talks about, right away, and I took it, you know, and all those things that I swore I was never going to do, I just did in an instant. And after that happened, I decided that I was going to move back to Fresno because I was going to change my life, you know. And at this point, I didn't realize the progression of my disease. I didn't realize how powerless I was over alcohol. And I also didn't realize that no human power could relieve me from my alcoholism. At that point, I thought I could do it. And I moved back to Fresno on my 19th birthday, and that was the day I was going to change, and I was going to become all these things that I had, these ideas that I had, these ideas that my family had for me. I was going to become all those things. And it was my 19th birthday, so I wasn't going to stop that day. I was stopped the next day. Like, I was entitled to do that. And that 19th birthday lasted like 2 years for me. And at this point, I started to, you know, lie, cheat, and steal. I would steal from my family. I wouldn't come home. You know, my mom was worried sick about me. I was drinking every day. I was in a relationship with somebody, and he died of this disease, like, right in front of me. And I still couldn't get sober. And it's not surprising to me, you know, our book talks about bringing those memories, like we cannot bring into our consciousness with sufficient force of memories and the humiliation and suffering from even a day or a week ago. And those things that happened, like him dying and the car accidents that I had been in, and the guilt, shame, and remorse that I had for taking advantage of my family the way that I did and hurting my little brother, like those things did not stop me from taking another drink. You know, and that's why I'm a firm believer of my God-given sobriety date, because if it was up to me, I would have got sober before I had done all of that. So about at age like 20, I guess I was 20, I went to my first treatment center. I don't really remember much about it, and they had to detox me there, and I just remember smoking cigarettes and hanging out with the guys, and I thought I was in paradise, you know. I was in Arizona, and it was like I got a vacation from my life. And 45 days later, they told me that I had to go to another treatment center, and I couldn't figure out why, you know. And it was basically because I was trying to see the psychiatrist to get all these different meds from him, and they didn't feel like I was ready to be sober. You know, but something happened at that treatment center. My family got to come visit me there. And they talked a lot about spirituality. I was all the way out in Arizona. And, you know, I was raised Mormon. And on my mom's side. And then my dad's side had, like, no belief whatsoever. And so, I don't know, my views were kind of skewed, I guess. And I was not about to be Mormon. I was drinking every day. I just couldn't see how those two fit together, you know. And so, I didn't really, like, have this conception of a God or anything. And I do understand when the book tells us that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I think I was praying to something a lot of times, you know, when I was out there drinking, either to die or to get me out of any type of jam that I was in. But, you know, I didn't have much of a spiritual solution at that point. But what happened there is that my dad, when he was attending the groups and stuff, apparently he got something out of that rehab, you know, and so that like $65,000 big book that I went home with from that rehab, my dad got something different, and that was a relationship with a God of his own understanding. And I didn't really realize that until later, but it's important, because my dad and I didn't have the greatest relationship. He worked all the time, and I hated him for it. And I didn't really realize that everything that I had in my life and all the stuff that I was provided with was because he worked his butt off for our family. I just resented him. You know, and so after that rehab, they sent me to another one, and they flew me into Orange County, which is where I'm from, actually. That's where I was born. And it was all women. And at this point, I knew my life was over. Like, I couldn't believe already that I had to go to a second treatment center. And then they were going to put me into a treatment center with all women. And I thought that was ridiculous. I thought it was an extreme punishment, really, because I didn't hang out with the girls. I hung out with the guys. I drank like the guys. You know, I probably acted and talked like a guy, too. It wasn't very cute, but that's what I was used to, and I was not about to go and, A, be in treatment, and B, be in a sorority. That's how I felt, you know, and I cried and cried and cried when I was there, and the only solution I had to that uncomfortability was to drink. And so I drank, like, almost every day I was in that treatment center, and it was 3 months. And I would just drink in the closet. And I'd get caught from time to time. And I'd get newcomers drunk. And, hey, they had me in there in the treatment center during New Year's, you know. Like, I didn't really understand that people were to stay sober during those type of holidays. And I was on lockdown in that treatment center a lot, just stuck in the house, you know. And 2 weeks before I got out of that treatment center, my uncle passed away of this disease. And he was like a father to me. And still I couldn't get sober, you know, once again, like, those circumstances didn't matter. I was still powerless over alcohol at that point, and there was nothing that anybody could do, you know. After that, I moved again. I was really good at leaving all my crap behind wherever I was, leaving a big mess for whoever I was around, and moving and taking off. And I never understood that, like, I took that problem with me wherever I went, you know, and coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I find out that I'm, like, you know, spiritually maladjusted and stuff. At the time, I didn't know that. I just thought, all right, here I go. New place, you know, new scene. And once again, I'm going to change. And once again, I'm going to finally go to school. And I'm going to hold a job. And I wasn't employable. You know, I'm a really big nerd, but I wasn't able to get to school to even excel upon my nerdiness at that point. Like, I just, none of that stuff would happen for me because I was still drinking. And I didn't have a solution. And the treatment centers, I'm sure they offered me one, but I didn't hear it, you know, at that point. And I moved to Hollywood, And needless to say, I didn't get sober there either. It's not Hollywood's fault, but I did what I was going to do, and I enrolled in school, and I was still drinking, and I thought that because I was 21 years old that that's what you do. Unfortunately for me, in the way that I drink, you can't drink that way and improve upon your life or build new structures in your life. You can't go to work, and you can't go to school, and I would try so hard, and I never understood it, and I actually got a job. And as soon as I got that job, I decided I was going to get in a relationship. And I met this guy, and he was 3 days out of prison. And he had everything that I had ever wanted to change the way that I felt. And that was it for me. That's what I lived for. And at this point, alcohol and other things dictated, when I woke up and what I was going to do that day and who I was going to lie, cheat, and steal from just to change the way that I felt. I was self-centered, I would say before I started drinking. And at this point, I was so selfish, and I hurt a lot of people. I lasted out in Hollywood about, a year and a half or so, and I stayed in this relationship, and this guy was physically abusive, and I was just as physically abusive right back. I was living a life that I never was raised to live. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know how to live the life, really. I probably had seen it in movies or something, but this guy was in it. He'd been in the gang for 10 years, and I just jumped right in and acted like I knew what I was doing, And I stuck out like a sore thumb, okay? I'm like blonde and white, and they questioned me, okay? I really had to build some trust to be like in, but I behaved the way that they did, and I did everything that they did, and on the inside, I really wanted to die. Like, I wasn't raised to do those things. I wasn't raised to be a criminal. I wasn't raised to hurt my family the way that I did. I wasn't raised to, steal time from my little brother, because all of the time that my parents spent trying to throw roadblocks in my way to get me sober and, or worrying about me and all those sleepless nights should have been spent on him, and his accomplishments. And I wasn't raised to do those things, and I felt so ashamed. And the only thing that would relieve me of that shame, temporarily, was a drink. And so that's what I continued to do. And I remember that my brother plays baseball, and he was playing for Fresno State, and they were playing out in Fullerton, okay, and that wasn't very far from where I lived, and so I had an opportunity to go watch him play, and it was just one of those days again, where I woke up and I drank and I did my thing, and I knew that I had to be there at a certain time, and my mom must have told me like 40 times what time I had to be there, and I still couldn't make it. And in the book it talks about that. It actually gives us this, a little scenario or whatever about somebody that has an important business card that needs to be met, and they take a drink, a day or two before, and no matter how long they've known about that time and that date and what they're supposed to do, they just can't make it, because of that craving and that obsession and that allergy to alcohol. And that's what happened to me, and I didn't make it there on time, of course. I missed. He was a starting pitcher. He pitched like 7 innings, and I didn't make it there on time. And I showed up for like the last 2 innings, and after the game, I went up to him, tried to act like nothing was going on, and he looked at me and he said, "I'm done. Like, I'm so tired of this. You have got to change something or I'm out. You're going to die." And it crushed me at that time. That's my younger brother. He's 4 years younger, but we were really close. And he was done with me at that point, and it hurt, and I drank. That's all I knew to do, And I drank for like another 6 months, and finally, as a result of that, I became homeless. Like, I lost the crappiest place ever that I lived in out in Hollywood, and but it was expensive because it was right there on Sunset Boulevard, and so I really had to hustle to be able to like pay that rent and support my habit and everything else. And I did that by stealing from other people and robbing people and doing fraud and stuff like that I didn't even know how to do. Like, I had to teach myself, I had to like survive out there. And I just never really understood that, like, because I took that drink is why I continue to do these things. And I look back at my life and I'm like, how the heck did I get here? And I got there because of the progression of my alcoholism and because I was powerless over alcohol. And I didn't understand it at the time, but when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I began to understand my condition of alcoholism, I understood how I got there. I understood how I hurt the people that I love the most, you know, and how my disease just spewed out into everybody's lives. And at this point, I waited till the sheriff came and evicted me, because you get a few extra days if you do that. And after they knocked on the door, I knew the gig was up. And the guy that I was with, I think he was feeling that I was going to leave, and he had me in a corner of that place with a machete over my head. And he was threatening to kill me if I left, you know. And at that point, I just was kind of freaking out a little bit. Like, I was probably going to die. And, you know, I wished for that so many times, but really, like, I really just wanted to live, but I did not like the way that I was living. And after about 10 minutes of that, he finally, like, let up. And I called those people that I continued to hurt through my alcoholism. I called those people that I continued to take advantage of, that I lied to on a daily basis, you know, that I caused so much, like, worry in their lives. And that was my family, you know, and I called my family. I called my mom, and she called my dad. And my dad was out at the duck club, like, hunting or whatever. And he never did cell reception there, but he did. You know, and so God right there knew, I guess, that it was time for me to come home. And he called his brother that lived in Burbank, and his brother came and picked me up on a street corner. You know, and all I had a pair of cowboy boots on me, and a laptop, and my little chihuahua. And I was standing out there waiting, ready to go, and any other belongings that I had were in, you know, in that place. All that crap that I collected over some time was in that place, and I couldn't take it with me because I was walking everywhere. I didn't have a car, didn't have a license. You know, I had warrants out from my arrest, you name it, and on paper I was nobody. And so I just left everything behind and got in the car. You know, my family came down and got me. And at this point I knew the gig was up, but I thought that I could probably still drink. Like, I knew anything else I was doing was that I was done, but I thought I probably could still drink, you know, and I had that in my mind. And when my parents got there at 2 in the morning, they came and got me. My dad was, like, hell-bent on going back to that place. And now there's, like, 5 or 6 gang members in that place just living it up until some other sheriffs come to evict them, you know, and they all got guns, and they're loaded, and they're drunk. And he wanted to go back there and get a box of my stuff, and I'm like, really, it's not that important, you know. And he drove me and my mom over there, and he made us duck in the car. And he walked through the alley, and he knocked on the back of this door, and he demanded my stuff back. And, you know, at that point, that moment for me is when I received that gift of desperation. Because this man that I hated with all of my heart had just went through and went and faced a situation that I thought he wasn't going to make it out alive to get a box of my stuff. Like, stuff, you know? And at that point, I knew that he loved me. And when he got back in the car and we drove home in silence, and it was complete silence, I had a lot of time to think, you know. But the sad thing was, I still didn't think I was going to quit drinking. I just knew that I wasn't going to continue to, like, use the drugs or behave the way that I did. You know, and come to find out, even sober, I can behave the way that I did. And when I got back to Fresno, my parents told me in order to live in their home, I had to go to 5 AA meetings a week. And I thought that was a death sentence. And I could not believe that they were going to make me do that. I acted like I was too busy. I was unemployable, first of all. You know, I had nothing going for me. All I had was time on my hands, which is not a good situation for me anyway. And I told them, if I have to go to 5 AA meetings a week, then I'm just going to drink. Because who's going to say that they're an alcoholic that many times and not drink? You know? And and so, but, you know, I followed their instructions and I went. And, you know, I knew this girl that had gotten sober about a year before I did. And my mom told me that she was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I called this girl up that I knew very well who I thought was the president of AA. And I'm like, listen, here's my life story. And I got honest with somebody for the first time, you know. Granted, I did it through MySpace at the time, okay. But I told her everything that had gone on. And she told me to meet her at a meeting. You know, I didn't have a car. So I went to that first meeting, and it was in December. And it was the end of the month, so it was a birthday meeting. And I walked in there, and I was so scared, but I was not going to let anybody know it because I was taught better than that. You know, I had my hood on. I still thought I was in a gang. And I walked in, and I'm mugging everybody, like, you know, thinking I'm going to just, like, fight some people if they look at me wrong, and I'm not going to talk to anybody. And on the inside, I was shaking because I did not want everybody there to find out, like, who I really was, you know, and what I had done. And I sat in that meeting, and I sat kind of in the front next to the president of AA, and I didn't have a car at the time, and so my mom had to take me, you know, and I got sober at 23, and that was kind of embarrassing, but I told her the meeting was 45 minutes long. I don't know if you guys have ever been to a 45-minute long meeting, but I don't think that they exist. But I told her that so I could run the hell out of that meeting and get in her car, you know, just in case. And it was an hour and a half, poor thing. She could have been it. She waited. And I sat in that meeting, and I sat next to this guy, and he starts to talk to me. He's like, hey, I like your shoes. And I'm like, he wants me, you know? I was so scared on the inside, but my ego was so huge. And I was delusional at that point, you know? I've been delusional for a long time. Like, the book tells us how our problems pile up on us and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And I've been living that way for years, you know? And I got in there, and I was a mess, but I listened. And I listened to these people celebrate, you know, 12, 15, 20, 20 years of the Village Group, and their December birthdays, and that's the month that I got sober, too. And and I remember thinking, like, people don't stay sober that long. Like, this is ridiculous, you know? But I stayed at the meeting, and I went the next day, too, you know? And I continued to go back. And I asked that president of AA, who was a friend of mine, to be my sponsor. And I text messaged her because I didn't want her to say no. It was like I had this big fear of rejection, or like I was like going to go on a date or something. They were going to say no, and I did not want to hear no. You know, I had no like self-worth at the time. I didn't understand that by her helping me, she was going to stay sober. I didn't get all of that. And so I text messaged her like, please sponsor me. And she said, no, I don't sponsor through text message. If you want me to sponsor you, you have to ask me face to face. And I thought, well, this deal's off. Yeah. I was only getting a sponsor because everybody else in the room had a sponsor, and I don't want to look bad. And so I waited a few days, and I saw her again, and I asked her face-to-face to sponsor me. And, you know, immediately she got me into the big book. And immediately she told me the importance of being of service. And at that time, like, you know, I didn't really have a message to carry, but I was able to carry the alcoholic to the message because I had a car. And it's taken a little while for me to get that, but I got a car, and so I was like the AA taxi my first year, you know, and that's what I did to be of service. And every time I went into a meeting, I gave my phone number out to somebody that had a woman, she stressed that, a woman, you know, less time than I did. And, you know, that whole question thing about the relationships for the first year, I think my first sponsor told me the same thing, but she ended the whole statement with, I didn't do that, so I'm not going to tell you, you have to do that. But it was suggested to me, you know. And my whole experience with that is that every time I got into a relationship, I was either going to drink or work the steps. And by the grace of God, I was able to stay here and work the steps. Every time one of those things ended in my first year, because, man, I was crazy. But I think somebody was probably better off dating me my first year than probably by year two and a half, because I was more crazy then. But I did. I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got involved in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got involved in that big book, and I loved the big book. And it was because within that book, you know, it described me, and the doctor's opinion specifically was talking about my alcoholism, and I never in my life, like, thought that anybody else understood it, you know? And so I dove into that book, and I worked with Seth as a sponsor my first year, and I absolutely loved Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I wasn't so scared anymore. And I lived my life for AA at that point because I wasn't employable or anything. And I didn't get a job until like near the end of my first year, and I was employed by my parents working like six hours a week, okay. So I had a lot of time on my hands. And I was like a meeting whore, you know. Like I went everywhere. Like I just went to every fellowship, and I made all kinds of friends, and, you know, young, old, whatever. And I absolutely loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the first time I thought, I'm going to be good at this, you know, and I was going to be the best sponsee, and I would race for other sponsees and the steps and, you know, like, all of this stuff. And, like, after a year and a half of that, I got tired, you know. I was, like, so tired of being good. I got good, like, way too fast. And, you know, in that time, though, like, I was able to make my amends, you know, to my family, specifically to my brother, you know, and that amends was so humbling because I had hurt him, you know. I had driven a few times with him in the car while I was under the influence, you know. He had seen a lot of battles between me and my parents, and I stole a lot of time from him. You know, I did a lot of things that you shouldn't have to see your older sister, like, do. And I made him drug test for me one time. You know, like, there were so many things that I had done to hurt him. And when I went to make that amends, I'm like, at this point, I could cry all the time, you know. And so I'm, like, sobbing through this amends. And he started to cry, too. And I'm like, oh, don't be doing that, you know. I'm already feeling convicted over here. But I was able to ask him, like, is there anything I'm leaving out, you know. And I think I covered it all because it took a long time. But, you know, what I got to tell him is that if I continue to live by these spiritual principles, I don't ever have to hurt him in that way again, you know. And I've been able to do that because of a loving God and this program. And so my family relationship started to get better, you know, and they started to change in my eyes because I was working the steps, you know, because I was able to do an inventory and have my character defects pointed out to me, because at the time my first inventory that I did was like 6 people long. I had like 6 resentments on there. And I got sent home when I showed my sponsor that, and she's like, you need to do this again. I'm like, I'm sober, I'm not mad, you know. And I did not understand that what I was going to find out through that inventory process was you know, not only my part in all those situations, but more importantly, like, my thinking and what drove my behaviors, and how I was unable to change those behaviors with my thinking, you know? I thought I had it all backwards. And, you know, fast forward to about 2 years sober, my brother, he was on the Fresno State College World Series baseball team, and I got to go with my family out there to Omaha and to watch all this thing unfold. And that right there was a testament to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. The people in the room could show me how to grow up and to be a part of and, like, to be present. And I got to do that. And I was on cloud 9, you know. And the last day that we were there, the last game that they played, my brother got to pitch that final game. And I'm his biggest fan, you know. And at this point, like, our relationship was so much better. And I was a sister to him, you know. And I got to watch one of the most important events in his life. And after the game, they had all the reporters and stuff, you know, on the field and talking to him. And he paused, and on national TV, he looked up and he said, "My sister's here, and I love her." And right then and there, like, I knew that I never ever wanted to go back and drink the way that I did, because of that I had hurt so many people, you know, including him. And I just was so grateful to God for Alcoholics Anonymous and for the steps, you know, and that I was able to be a part of that. And, you know, after that, you know, for like the next 6 months of my sobriety, I was kind of lazy when it came to step work. And, you know, I was lazy probably in all areas of my life, but most importantly, I was lazy in developing that relationship with a higher power. And I became miserable in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to that point, as, you know, what's been taught to me is step zero, and I was hopeless. And I felt like AA had nothing to offer me. You know, I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want to live either. And it was like, if I could only find a way out of this life. Like, I was so miserable. And, you know, what happened for me is that I was approached by somebody different than my sponsor to take me through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took that opportunity. And this guy showed me, you know, just how he was. He took me through the book just how he was, but I had a new experience with that book. And we started with the preface, and in there it tells you exactly how to read the Big Book. And it has, you know, 3 little statements, and it talks about, as you're going through the book, to see if, like, you know, yes, that happened to me. Yes, I felt like that, and most importantly, yes, I believe this can work for me too. And I went through the Big Book with that state of mind, you know, the whole time, and we turned statements into questions, and I became very clear on my first step. You know, I don't even know that I had really admitted to my innermost self, like, through the first few years that I was an alcoholic. I don't think I understood that, because my innermost self, you know how it says deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God? That's admitting that to God, you know, and I didn't grasp that, and it took me a while. And I was able to see all the mental defenses I had in sobriety, you know. You know, by the grace of God, I didn't drink during that time, but what I realized is I can't stay sober on God's grace, you know, forever. And I needed to, some action needed to be done, you know, if I wanted to stick around and experience those things that those intangible things that I had already experienced within Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went through the book with him, and we worked through the steps. And, you know, on the second step, I was able to come up with my own conception of a higher power. And I had this idea, you know, that, like, because of all the stuff that I had done and because of all the people that I had harmed and everything else, that there was not a God out there that was going to love me, that was going to take care of me, and that was going to see that I could stay sober. And I couldn't grasp that. But when I worked through the second step with this guy, you know, I finally was able to really have my own God concept, you know, and because of that, like, I'm still here. And I was able to work the third step knowing and trusting, you know, in God that, like, I was going to be able to get through the rest of the steps, but that I didn't have to live my sobriety one day at a time, you know, like, oh, hope I don't drink tomorrow, because the directions are laid out in that book of exactly what I needed to do. You know, I had to maintain my spiritual condition, you know, and I got to do an inventory and look at all these ideas that I had. And my life was run on all these old ideas and principles, and this inventory took forever. But I was so grateful to be able to do it that way, you know, and to see what was really dragging my life. You know, and actually back, going back for a minute, when we were doing the first step, the first time around I had to, like, list everything I did to get alcohol, and it was the weirdest first step ever, but my sponsor, the president of AA, didn't know, I don't think, at the time or whatever. And this time around I got to look at that actual admission of being powerless over alcohol, and then I got to look at that second half of the first step, which was the unmanageability. Because I thought unmanageability was like when I didn't have a car, or, you know, like maybe I wasn't making enough money and I didn't have all those material things. And it was that internal unmanageability that almost killed me in sobriety. And I got to look at those things by looking at the bedevilments in the book on page 52. You know, it talks about being a prey to misery and depression, unable to have personal relationships, you know, unable to make a living, and not just financially, but make a living, like start living. You know, living life. And I got to look at those things and see how my life was affected by those, and to see, like, what my ideas were to fix them. Now, I'm not right in the mind. We already discovered that, you know, and maybe what God's ideas were to fix them. And the choice of the two, I would have been much better than what God's ideas, you know. And so I trusted that God through the process of going through the steps again. And, you know, I worked through the steps again, and I continued to stay in service for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I absolutely love it, and it's important to my recovery because the book tells us so many times, you know, why it's important for us to be in service, and that's because we get to stay sober. You know, and in the back of the book, and it has those stories about Dr. Bob's nightmare, and he lists the four reasons why he was of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my favorite part of service is carrying the message, you know, is sponsoring women and taking them through the steps and taking them through the book the way that I got to go through the book, you know, and so they can have that type of experience. And but what he says is that he does it because it's a sense of duty, you know, because it's a pleasure. Because every time he does, he takes out a little bit of insurance, you know, against a possible slip. And also because he's paying back a debt to somebody that had helped him. You know, and, like, those are the reasons why I'm of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And our book stresses in so many different ways about how doing that will keep us sober. And I know that it's definitely a part of my triangle, you know. And because it's a part of my triangle, the other side, the unity service and recovery, the unity part for me is being able to carry the message to alcoholics and to be unified among, you know, the process of working the steps and having that spiritual awakening. And it's because of that spiritual awakening that my life is, like, incredible today. You know, and I still have a lot of service positions, like sometimes too many that I get crazy. And I get to serve this year as a chairperson of Fresno County Young People's and Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's incredible because we started our group 4 years ago, and there was like 12 of us or something, you know, and now there's like so many people, you know, and you get to watch people around you recover, and it's amazing. And you know, just this past weekend, I got to be at my brother's wedding. And, man, it was just another one of those moments for me, you know. First of all, my whole family was there. Our whole family was there. But I'm talking about the four of us, you know. And I was sober, so nobody was worrying about me. You know, but when I was out there, I would never have been asked to be a part of that wedding because you couldn't trust me. I probably would have ruined the whole thing, you know, because alcohol was so important. And, I got to be in his wedding, and, you know, like, I was a part of the bridal party, and I got to show up, you know, and I got to be there. And I started, right when I started to walk down the aisle, my brother starts to lose it, you know. And actually, before the wedding started, my dad, the one that had no God in his life and the one that I hated for so long, he gathered us together and he said a prayer, you know. And that was so amazing to me because this program has worked for me, but it's worked for my family too. And because they've seen me recover by spiritual principles, so have they. You know, and it's a family disease for us, you know. And so that whole experience at the wedding was like so crazy to me because I'm sober and I knew like why I was here, you know, and why I'm here because I get to stay sober to be a part of my family today, you know, and I get to be a daughter and I get to be a sister. And I walk down the aisle, my brother starts sobbing, you know, when he sees me. And that was another very important day in his life, and I didn't ruin it, you know. And him and my mom were dancing at the end of I've never been married, so I don't know what all this stuff is called, but at a reception or whatever. And halfway through their dance, he came and got me. You know, and we got to dance out there together. And that's what our relationship is like today because of this program and because of a loving God. You know, and I came back from that wedding, and I'm still on cloud nine about it. You know, like those are the things that make me so content today. You know, the alcohol doesn't rule my life anymore. And sometimes my crazy thinking rules my life, but I have a solution for that, you know. And sometimes my behavior is bad, and I have a solution for that in steps 10 and 11. But my most important solution today is a loving God, you know. And I've got to capitalize on the structures built in my life because of this program, because of that relationship I've developed. And I don't know, me and my first sponsor, we always joke around, but we always close with saying that, you know, I love God and I love AA, and thank you for having me here today.